Welcome, this is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. It is the 5th of November, 2011, and today we're honored to be joined on the line by a man who needs no introduction. Suffice it to say, it is none other than Daniel Eschelin of The True Story of the Bilderberg Group and the author of the 2010 book Shadow Masters by Trinday Publishing. Daniel Eschelin, it's an honor and a pleasure to have you on. Thank you for joining us again.
James, thank you so much for having me on your show.
Excellent. Well, it is good to talk to you, and especially good to talk to you now in the wake of an article that just came out on The Guardian, November 2nd. Russian Viktor Boot convicted over Colombian arms deal. And this, I know, is a case that you've been following very closely for a very long time, as you spent 6 months in Thailand actually attending his extradition hearings and interviewing Viktor Boot himself. And a lot of that research has been collected in Shadow Masters, in which you devote a lengthy section to Viktor Boot's case. And I know that you also have a lot of documentation on this on your website, danieleschelin.com, so I'll direct people there if they want even more detailed info. But first, for people who are just picking this story up and don't really know who Viktor Boot is, perhaps you can tell us about the story and what he has been accused and now convicted of.
Well, I think the best place to start is with the Hollywood film, the rendition of what Viktor Boot allegedly is like, called The Lord of War, starting on Nicolas Cage. And most people who know anything about the story of Viktor Boot know or allegedly know him from this film, because, again, I don't know what's, you know, the truth is stranger than fiction or vice versa, but certainly Viktor Boot is a fascinating character. According to the United States government, he's the biggest arms dealer in the history of the world, a man the United States has been pursuing for over a decade, and finally in Thailand in March 2008, they're able to capture him, and now then extradite him to the United States last year. And just a couple of days ago, a verdict was reached in the New York court, and Viktor, unfortunately, in February of 2012, will be sentenced to life in prison. But again, the story of Viktor Boot is a story that begins in Africa in the 1990s. Viktor Boot, in 1991, was a translator working out of Mozambique for the Russian government there. And when the Soviet Union fell apart, he decided to stay in Africa because he and his brother Sergei, they loved airplanes, they loved flying. So they, over the next 2 years, were able to buy a couple of old Antonov 24 airplanes. And basically, they got into the business of transporting, cargo business. And in the 1990s, most of Africa was ablaze in regional wars. So most of the Western cargo companies pulled out. And Viktor Boot, literally, by 1995, owned about 90% of the cargo business in Africa, which is a mega monopoly. You know, not even Microsoft could claim to have 90% of any market anywhere in the world. When the wars began to subside, late 1996, the Americans, the French, the Dutch, the Germans, you know, the British, they all wanted to get back in, but they couldn't get back into Africa because the entire continent was literally controlled by Viktor Boot, not controlled from a point of view of as mafia controls territory, but rather controlled in the cargo business terms, controlled. So they didn't need the American government. The African leaders didn't need the British, didn't need the French. And needless to say, if you run operations on African soil, or anywhere in the world for that matter, you need to be on the ground, because most NGOs, most non-governmental agencies, they all are basically controlled by foreign intelligence services. So if you want to have an operation of any kind, or original wars created out of nothing or nowhere, then needless to say, you have to be in situ, something that, with Viktor Boot controlling the entire African continent and all the cargo routes, the Americans simply couldn't find a way to get back in. So they created this myth of Viktor Boot being this phrase, merchant of death, which was put forward by one of the British ministers at the time. And it stuck. And in 2011, Viktor Boot is no longer Viktor Boot, but a merchant of death. Over a period of time, between 1996 and 2002, Viktor Boot was gradually pushed out of Africa. In 2002, he went back to living in Russia. By 2007, he was literally broke. He didn't have any money. And in 2008, an operation was put together by the DEA in Thailand, where allegedly Viktor Boot was trying to sell shoulder tear missiles to the FARC terrorists, where Viktor Boot, in fact, was trying to sell his last two airplanes to make ends meet. And that's how he was caught. And the rest, as we say, is history.
It certainly is becoming history at this point. As the conviction now, obviously it seems that he's just going to be imprisoned, and it doesn't seem that there's any way to really reverse this tide. But so it's your impression that he wasn't involved in this in any way, shape, or form, or that he wasn't actually working for some intelligence operation from some company?
Well, Victor Booth, I've known Victor for years, and Victor was never involved in any kind of operation whatsoever. He was involved in cargo business. And in fact, if you watch carefully, when he was brought to the United States, extradited in November of last year by the United States government, United Nations arms inspectors, they all came out and all said, at best, you could claim him to be a arms dealer, not the arms merchant. In other words, if he sold anything at all, it would have been a very small part of his shipping cargo empire. But Victor Booth moved anything in Africa. He moved anything from ostriches to ostrich eggs to refrigerators and washing machines. And he mostly also moved anything that foreign leaders in African continent required. So he was never into the arms business itself. He was into shipping. And there's been a lot of talk in the American media that Victor Booth was part of the KGB. Booth was never KGB. Booth was Army. And the insinuation is very simple. See, the idea is that Victor Booth is a pawn, and Russia, of course, is the end game. If you can somehow discredit Russia as a nation, destroy their diplomacy, you can actually go a long way in gaining what we call the One World Company Limited, from my book on the Bilderberg Group. It's not about one world government. It's not about corporations controlling the world, at the expense of governments and nation states. So the idea is that Victor Booth, the KGB officer, couldn't get his hands on any of the weapons. The only way he could actually do that is if a strong empire nation, an evil empire in this case, Russia by insinuation, would supply him with all these weapons. So Russia was literally, it became a pariah state, put in the same in the same bracket with Iran, North Korea, Cuba, Venezuela. And the idea again is the same. If you can destroy Russia's credibility, you're undermining their appeal on the international arena. And needless to say, this is obviously part of the plan to destroy Russia, because it's the only nation in the world that actually stands between One World Company Limited and us and freedom.
So then you mentioned that he had the 95% almost total monopoly over the African cargo shipping business, and that was one reason that it was necessary to take him out of the equation from the U.S. point of view. But what was the point then of the 2008 sting? By that point, as you say, he was almost completely penniless. So what threat did he pose to the system at that time?
Well, he didn't pose any threat at all, because since 2002, he was peacefully living in Russia. The idea was that, again, there are many ways to discredit and destroy Russia's credibility. Victor Booth is one way. And Victor Booth, again, is just a pawn. Behind Victor Booth, allegedly, if you're the United States government, is Russia, supplying Victor Booth with all these weapons of mass destruction, weapons that, kill millions and maim millions of people across the world. Then you have other operations working and trying to undermine Russia's credibility, such as, for example, all the drugs which are being pushed from Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan into Russia through Chechnya, the international airport in Grozny, and that kills about 35,000 Russians a year. And again, the people who actually do drugs in Russia, all the drugs are being pushed from Afghanistan. These are the youth between 16 and 35. This is the bracket which basically is the future of Russia. And Russian Minister Anti-Drugs Ivanov publicly stated that he has asked the United States government and the British government and the NATO alliance in Afghanistan to do everything in their power to stop the drug flow into Russia, and they basically refused. Again, the idea is very simple. If you can destroy the future of Russia, you're destroying Russia as a nation. Also, you have 70 secret bases being built in Afghanistan by the United States government. All these bases have one objective in mind. That objective is to attack the southern flank of Russia in case of a war against the Russian Federation. Again, so there are many ways which the preparations are being made to actually try to destroy Russia as a nation. Because, again, you have in the world, as things stand today, you have two countries that stand in the way of one world government or one world company, limited, call it whatever you want. You have China and you have Russia. But China is not a military force. China is an economic force. China, for example, doesn't have any way or knowledge or know-how how to, for example, make a mini-nuclear weapon. out of plutonium. Only four nations have the technology. That's the Russians, the Americans, the French, and the Israelis. Okay, so the Chinese don't have a way of actually creating this fairly simple technology, although it's very, very complicated. Obviously, they're not in any way a military enemy. So the only military foe that stands in the way of this total control, total dominance over the world is Russia. So that's why all these attempts are being made to destroy Russia's credibility. And Viktor Butin also has another objective from the DA's point of view, to justify these incredible budget spending on actually trying to capture not Viktor Butin himself, but the idea behind it, because, for example, DEA right now is petitioning the United States Congress, trying to expand surveillance, trying to expand secret operations on foreign soil, where foreigners, non-Americans who have never stepped foot in American territory, for example, can be captured and brought to the United States for trial under drummed-up charges, as we saw in the case of a Russian pilot, which was brought to, I can't remember his name, to the United States in September, and the government tried to make him testify against Viktor Butin. He never did because they didn't even know Viktor Butin. And this is basically where we're at right now.
Well, of course, you do know Viktor Butin. You've had the chance to speak to him on multiple occasions. Have you spoken to him since he was actually extradited to the U.S.?
No, I have not, because first of all, I cannot get into the United States myself. I'm barred from entering the country. Allegedly, I'm a terrorist. I'm on all the no-fly lists imaginable and then some, not because I'm a terrorist, but simply because the government doesn't want people to know the truth. And as I explained in the Shadow Masters, the truth is very, very different from what the American government paints Viktor Butin out to be, you know. I've spoken, you know, to him through my lawyer, and also through Viktor Butin's wife. But again, it's astounding to me and to the people who actually worked the case back in Thailand, trying to help Butin, just how little was done, and the mistakes which were made in the case are the same mistakes which were made in the case in Thailand, for example. The lawyer that represented Viktor in the United States, Albert Dayan, I mean, he's more apt to sell tickets in a zoo than actually being a lawyer for anybody in this world. Yet this is the same scenario which was played out in Thailand, because, for example, the lawyer who represented Viktor there in Bangkok, a man by the name of Sham Ruen, worked directly for the DEA, something which, again, once we explained it to Viktor, he simply couldn't understand or believe. But this man, Sham Ruen, who represented Viktor in Thailand, for example, he was a personal lawyer for one of the Thai's admiral, whose son, all right, by the name of Jimmy, was working part-time for the DEA. So obviously the question is, if you have this man who is actually working for the DEA, who do you think he represents, Viktor Butin, or being just an informant for the DEA working in Viktor Butin's camp? And the same thing can be said about this man, Albert Dayan. I have no idea if he's actually a DEA informant, or he was bought by the DEA, or he's simply incompetent, which probably is the case. But the point is that the only thing that matters in this entire Viktor Butin case is that the alleged shoulder-to-air missiles, which was allegedly selling to the alleged FARC terrorists back in Thailand, not only were they never found, but there was actually no shoulder-to-air missiles, because the United States government never even bothered looking for the evidence itself. You see, so this only goes to show just how fabricated the entire case against Viktor Butin was in the United States court. But again, you know, there's still an appeals process left, and, you know, who knows what will happen in the end. But basically, again, Viktor Butin is a pawn of this macabre game, and he is being accused of terrible crimes, most of which he didn't commit, and some of which he simply, the things such as, you know, him being an arms dealer, for example. He never was an arms dealer. If anything, he transported, you know, small amounts of arms to nations which were under no United Nations embargo, because, again, most people think that arms trading is illegal. It's a legal business, legal. Drug dealing is illegal. But every nation in the world sells arms. They just don't want individuals such as you and I, Viktor Butin, to get into the business, because we're taking a share out of their market, you know, away from them. That is the only reason why individuals are being pursued and dissuaded from selling arms.
So what do you think Russia's reaction will be to this conviction?
Well, you know, it's because I understand the game. So, you know, it's an intricate game. And the game itself, you have to understand from the point of view of, see, Viktor Butin, one of the reasons he was arrested and brought to the United States, and we haven't talked about this publicly yet, has to do with what hit Pentagon on 9/11. You see, Pentagon was hit with a Russian missile which was stolen from Kursk, called Granite. Okay? Now, it was fired from a nuclear submarine. Nobody really knows who fired the weapon, but it was fired from a nuclear submarine on September 11th. And the United States government, after this, incident, you know, very kindly and politely is asking Russia to explain how they're, you know, because granted is a nuclear nuclear missile, you know, which usually comes equipped with a 500 kiloton nuclear warhead. Just to give you an idea, Hiroshima was 12 kilotons. This is 500 kiloton nuclear warhead. So unfortunately or fortunately, the it wasn't activated. So one of the reasons the United States is still a nation and not a little small piece of land in the middle of nowhere after the nuclear explosion. So the United States government after 9/11, once it was hit with Granat missile, it wasn't a Tomahawk, and obviously because Tomahawk is aluminum, is made out of aluminum, it certainly wasn't an airplane. So the Americans are asking the Russians, you know, what exactly they could explain how their nuclear warhead actually landed in the middle of the Pentagon. And, of course, Putin can't explain to anybody how the Granat missiles were stolen a year before that, in the year 2000, from the Kursk, then fired into the Pentagon on 9/11. So what happened was the United States government and Russians, they made a deal. They have to somehow write off the Granat missile. So this story was created, this cover story, you know, this in this macabre world of smoke and mirrors, where allegedly, if you remember, there was a story about the weapons called X-55, which were went missing when Ukraine became a nation state after the dissolution of the Soviet Union. And these missiles, according to the mainstream press, again, it's X-55, somehow ended up in Iran and China. You were talking about six weapons, two of which were equipped with nuclear warheads, were ended up in China, and six were ended up in Iran. And the idea behind this story is to make everyone understand that the man who transported these weapons and made the whole operation possible was a man by the name of Victor Booth, except that they can't say it publicly because, again, these weapons, X-55, although they're not as powerful as Granat P-700, which flies at a speed of 2.5 Mach, which is 2.5 times faster than the speed of sound, talking about almost 3,000 kilometers per hour. So the idea is that, again, they had to find a way to extradite Victor Booth to the United States, but they couldn't say, allegedly, that this X-55 missile was shipped by Victor Booth, or the Granat missile hit the Pentagon. So they created a story that Victor Booth is a merchant of death, selling weapons to all the dictators across the African continent and have to be put out of action because he's a menace to society.
Well, that's some staggering information, and I think I would be remiss in my duties if I wasn't asking you where that information was coming from, because that's quite a bombshell, quite literally.
Well, you know, that's one of the reasons why, because I know the inside story, and I know I also saw the reaction and the behavior of the Russian government in Thailand, and how that came about. I also understood that the people working for the Russian government in Thailand did everything in their power to make sure that Victor Booth did not go home, because there were instances, for example. You see, Victor Booth was arrested in Thailand on the 6th of March. He was arrested on this trumped up local charge of some local crime, which he couldn't have committed because he just made it. He literally crossed the border 2 hours before he went to the hotel and never left the hotel. And the reason that was done from the very beginning is because the Thai government tried to buy some time for the United States government to prepare the extradition case. Okay, and what happened was that in Thailand, once you're arrested on any charge, okay, you have up to 72 days for the prosecution to come up with the charges, and if they don't, they have to let you go. And the way it works is every 12 days, they have to ask the judge to renew, you know, the detention. So they renewed it once, they renewed it twice, and on the 33rd day, all right, on these trumped-up local theft charges, Victor Booth was released, and immediately, before he even walked out of the police precinct, rearrested, and then he was presented with the charges of extradition to the United States for crimes for allegedly trying to sell shoulder-to-air missiles to the FARC terrorists. And what had happened was that we had figured out that the second charges were illegal because the first charge is the only charge that actually stands because it's the first arrest. But because the first arrest was illegal, the second arrest couldn't have been legal according to the Thai law. And the United States government had 60 days from the day of the arrest to present the charges of extradition. So the Americans were working on the 60 days from the second arrest. And we realized that we could prove in court that it's the first arrest that counted. So Victor Booth had until the 5th of May to actually have the charges presented against him or go home. Unfortunately, some of the people working with us and trying to help us were people working from the Russian embassy in Bangkok, who turned out to be KGB or FSB, whatever you want to call them, officers. Once they realized the grave danger that the American government, and for extent, the Russian government as well, because in this case they were working together to try to extradite Viktor Bout to the United States. They went to court a week before, which is on the 30th of April, 2008, and basically asked the court to keep in mind that on the 5th of May, they would have to let Viktor Bout go home because there were no charges against him for this two-month period. Needless to say, the American government found out immediately because they were the other interested party in the case. They worked, 24 hours a day through the long May weekend and literally got the charges into court half an hour or an hour before the time expired. So again, had this not been the case, had these people working from within the Russian embassy in Thailand didn't do this, Viktor Bout on May the 5th would have been back home in Russia. So again, because I understand that the Russian government and the American government are actually working together against Bout in this case, anytime Foreign Minister Lavrov or anybody else comes out and says they're very concerned about the way the American government is actually prosecuting a case against Viktor Bout, you have to understand it for what it is, grandstanding and something which is being said for the benefit of the Russian people who simply don't understand the story behind the story. And again, in this particular case, it is Viktor Bout against the combined forces of the Russian and the American government, which is one of the reasons, again, he could never win this case because there's just too much firepower against him. And in my book, Shadow Masters, I interviewed a former nuclear intelligence officer from the 12th Chief Directorate of the Russian Federation, who actually knew the inside story on Granite because he was involved, obviously, in 12th Chief Directorate is the most important and the elite forces of the Russian intelligence. And again, these are the people who deal with nuclear intelligence. His name is Dmitry Halizov, and he lives in Bangkok. And this is just some of the background to this amazing story. It is an amazing story because, again, once you begin to understand how the whole thing was put together, you're awed by all these elements, all those pieces of the puzzle, or chess pieces, if you want to call them, which went into play against Viktor Bout and his interests.
Well, that is some astounding information, and I would love to go over it more, but I know we have very limited time today, and I know you are in France, so I want to get the latest G20 updates, but I assume you'll be developing that story, including the Pentagon angle of it, more in a future book or in some of your reporting, because I haven't heard that anywhere else before, so I'm interested
to hear
more.
Well, it's actually the interview which discusses the Pentagon hit by the Granite missile is in the book Shadow Masters. It's an interview, and also on my webpage with an extensive 27-page interview with Dmitry Halizov, which will explain all these elements to the story, the background to Viktor Bout, the background to the charges against him, and these whole machinations against his interests in Thailand, and now, of course, in the United States. There are other elements involved as well, such as the role his wife is playing, which is I don't really want to go into it right now, because the case is still pending in the appeals court, but there's still a lot to be said. Unfortunately, there's just too many elements which simply do not make any sense. What they say, if you're not good at something, if you try to do good and try to help someone, out of 100 chances, you're apt to get 5 or 10 right. The laws of probabilities. But when you get everything wrong all the time, I have the suspicion that somebody's actually doing something on purpose. And I know I'm being vague, but I'm being vague on purpose simply because, again, there's still a lot to be done and said in this case. But needless to say, we're following it closely. A lot of the things that actually happened in court in the United States, such as, for example, one of the damning evidence against Viktor Bout is this, the alleged information the American government got from his computer. Unfortunately, what the American government forgets is I was there from the beginning, and I know this case better than anybody else. And for example, Viktor's computer, which was taken from him when he was arrested in the business center, American government wanted to take it right back to the United States, but the Thai authorities, who arrested Viktor Bout simultaneously, but they're also there in the room, refused to allow Americans access to his computer because they had the Americans on one side, they had the Russian government on the other side, they had Viktor Bout in the middle. They didn't really understand who was who, and they certainly weren't going to let the Americans take key evidence out of Thailand, because in Thailand, law is law, and these people would go to prison. So they made sure that the computer went back to the police precinct, and what had happened was about half an hour later, Viktor Bout's first lawyer, Locke, was part of the president's Privy Council. It was classmate to the last three prime ministers of the country. And this is the man who was representing Victor Boot. He simply walked into the police precinct, and with his authority, he simply took his personal possessions back as his lawyer. So American government never had a chance to even open the laptop itself because it was an encrypted laptop, and they needed at least several hours to be able to get into it, and they never even have 15 minutes. So all this alleged information, which Americans had allegedly gleaned from Victor Boot's computer, is a blatant lie. But again, unfortunately, Boot's lawyer never even mentioned the computer. So the jury and the public got the impression that Victor Boot's computer was hacked by the Americans, and all this amazing information, priceless information, you know, the motherload of evil was revealed to the world, and that simply is not true, because his computer right now is back in Moscow with his brother, and in fact was from the very, very beginning.
All right. As I say, just incredible information, and I have my copy of Shadow Masters in my hand, and it looks like I'm going to have to reread Chapter 6 on nuclear gamesmanship with a fine-tooth comb, which I'll do as soon as we're off the air here. But moving along, as I say, you're in France right now. You're attending the G20. Tell us what's going on behind the scenes there.
Well, there's very little going on in terms of agreement. Just goes to show you that the United States of Europe is they're not so united. You know, there you have a lot more private and individual interests when pull comes to shove. What I can tell you, and this comes from our inside sources within the conference itself, and as you know, a few years back, you know, our people were able to, you know, get into the meeting in St. Andrews and steal key documents, which we posted with you. I believe that was in 2009 when I was in Thailand, if I'm not mistaken. So again, we have people working on this site who have access to all this information. And I said one of the reasons that Papandreou gave, you know, a 180-degree turn is that he was literally in his private meeting with Sarkozy. He was threatened with, you know, Sarkozy told him literally, you know, unless you pull the referendum, we're going to kill you. These were literally his words. And I'm saying this for the first time because I simply haven't done any interviews. So you could say this is a world exclusive. They threaten his life, and Papandreou knows. These are the big leagues. As I say in my Bilderberg book, the true story of the Bilderberg Group, Aldo Moro was killed after Kissinger threatened him. And Papandreou understands that unless he pulled the reform, he would also be killed. And this is actually the only reason why he went back on his word. And as far as the meeting itself, very little was reached, very little was accomplished, other than the Italians on the verge of default. You have Ireland and Portugal are dead men walking. Spain is a cadaver. So there's very little that actually can pull out of this. One of the things they did discuss very briefly, and not only at this meeting but at last year's Bilderberg meeting, which again is just a continuation of what they talked about last year, is creating two divisions of the European Union. One would be the division for the pigs, the second division, which would include the Portuguese, the Greek, the Italians, and the Spaniards, and so on, the Irish. And then the other division, the elite division, would be all these nations who could for now pay their way out of debt, such as France, Germany, etc. Except that, again, one of the other things discussed at the meeting, how little political will there is on the part of all these nations to actually work together. They're simply realizing that there's no future to the European Union as a union itself, but they simply cannot afford to say this publicly right now. So we'll see what happens. But again, I think it's in a situation where nobody really knows what's going to happen. There are no leaders in Europe who can actually lead nations out of this crisis on the one hand. And also on the other hand, James, as we've discussed this, you know, before, what we're seeing right now on the world stage, what we're seeing right now in Europe, this, you know, this wholesale destruction of the world economy, it's being done on purpose. Because, again, we're 7 billion people. We're living in this small planet called planet Earth with limited natural resources. You know, over the past 300 years, all the people, all the forces linked to characters such as Wilfred Leibniz, you know, they've known this for the last 300 years, as I've said, that progress and development are directly proportional to population density. So if you have progress, you have development, if you have technology, we're going to have a lot more people on the planet Earth. And then needless to say, if we get to 40, 80, 100 billion people, the question is, what are we going to do with all these people with limited natural resources? So people like David Rockefeller and company was just a metaphor for powerful people. You know, they understand that for them to be able to drink and eat, they need to make sure that we are dead, or at least most of us are, which is one of the reasons we're seeing this, you know, terminology such as, zero growth, zero progress. They're destroying nuclear energy, eliminating it, and replacing it with renewable energies, which simply have no future because they don't have the the density which you need to the power, call it whatever you want, to provide the necessary energy for 7 billion people on the planet Earth. So again, what we're seeing right now is part of this wholesale worldwide economic destruction whose only objective really is to reduce the world's population.
Unfortunately so, and I think my listeners will probably be familiar with that and the eugenics ideology that drives the elite who really believe themselves to be
exactly.
superior. Yeah. Well, I can't let that bombshell that you just dropped just go. If there's any other details you can tell us about the threat against Papandreou, I'd love to hear anything you have on
that. Well, you know, basically very little was said. They simply didn't have a lot of time. They discussed a lot of the alternatives, but there's simply no alternative. I mean, Greece is dead. There's nothing you can do about this nation. The best thing that Greece can do, and this is something that one of the reasons that the Sarkozy's and the Merkel's are so terrified of the consequences of is Papandreou actually thinking of leaving the union, and Zapatero was thinking of leaving the union, and of course if that happens, the entire edifice of European Union collapses, you know, into nothing. So they simply can't afford for Greece to leave, not because they want Greece, because it just leads to greater destruction on the part of the elite who understand that you've got to create this one world company limited. You destroy nation states, you take away their currencies, you destroy their constitutions, you destroy their culture, you destroy everything, and you create this pan world. We have corporations ruling the world on the name of the of governments, no, and then as the people. So the point of Papandreou's meeting with Sarkozy is that you know, to make sure he understood that he cannot leave the union and he has to accept the reforms, he has to withdraw this ridiculous proposal for actually consultation of the people. Imagine this in a democracy, people having to say, you know, having a say at something. Obviously, it doesn't make any sense. And another point, you know, which literally went on the radar, is this private meeting that President Obama had with Argentine President Kirchner. I don't know if you've heard about that.
No, I haven't. Please tell us about it.
Well, it's a very interesting story. You know, the President of the United States, you know, Barack Obama, asked for a private meeting with President of Argentina. You know, it's not the other way around. It's American President wanting to meet privately, you know, asking for an appointment. Now, you'd say, why would they do that? Well, drugs, again, is the name of the game. You see, one of the agreements which was reached by the Argentines and the Colombians for this new highway which is being built, you know, from one country to the other, and this highway is basically going to be the, you know, the drug route of the country. And the new satellite, which is being put into orbit again, that satellite has only one purpose to be, and that purpose is to make sure that you can actually track the drug shipments. So with Argentina squarely on the map of one of the biggest drug pushers right now in South America, along with Peru and Humala, you know, very interesting scenario developing with President Obama basically wanting part of the action. And that's one of the reasons why they met. Needless to say, you're not going to see it on the covers of the Wall Street Journal, but it was definitely on the agenda. Again, drugs is what makes the world economy go around. You're talking about a $900 billion business a year. And if you have the multiplying effect of, you know, of six of what that money actually means and stands for, you're talking about trillions of dollars of wealth, cash, which if you eliminate from the world financial system would actually completely destroy, wipe out the world finances immediately, you know? So again, several interesting points. One is that no decision was reached on anything at all at the European G20 meeting in Cannes. Number two, I know you can put it in any order you want, but Papandreou was threatened with you know, being with assassination unless he, you know, followed the reforms as outlined by the European Union, as outlined by the European Central Bank. And again, another interesting point is, you know, the drug union between the United States and Argentina. Kirchner is right in the middle of this thing. You know, her neoliberal policies and working together with people such as Humala in Peru. And Peru right now is the number one drug dealer in South America, surpassing Colombia and over the next couple of years. It's probably going to surpass any other nation on earth in the amount of drugs generated and sold on the world stage.
All right, an incredible amount of information to take in at any one time, so I'm probably going to have to re-listen to this interview a few times myself to go through all of this. But Daniel Eschelin, DanielEschelin.com, I know you're a very busy man, so thank you so much for your time.
If you want, again, you know, if we have like 30 seconds, I'll very briefly summarize again, you know, the Booth story, if I may.
Do it, yeah.
You know, Booth was, again, is is a man who's been working in Africa since 1991. He was arrested in 2008 by the American government, not because he's a merchant of death, but because simply a nuisance for the Americans. On the one hand, they wanted him out of Africa because they wanted to control the continent themselves, but on the other hand, they also wanted to hurt Russia as part of this global war against the interests of the Russian Federation, because again, if you're going to have your one-world government, you need to make sure that the only nation that actually stands in the way of this one-world government, one-world company, limited, Bilderberg-controlled, whatever you want to call it, is Russian Federation, because it's the only nation with the technology and nuclear know-how, actually more powerful than any other NATO alliance member. So Viktor Boot is just part of the story. Then you have the other elements, such as the drugs being pushed into Russia, such as the bases being created and built in Afghanistan, the manipulation of the world financial markets, etc. So again, Russian credibility is obviously at stake, and their strength is obviously a concern for the NATO alliance. That said, you have the American media, the European media, all controlled by the financial interests, such as Bilderberg Group and such as Rockefellers, etc., doing what they do best, making sure that the public, you know, the great unwashed, as they call us, understands that Viktor Boot is a terrorist, Viktor Boot is a criminal, and now that he's in prison, now that he will spend the rest of his life in his prison cell, we the people can sleep well, sleep peacefully, because, you know, the greatest menace to society has been removed. The real story is quite different. The story with Viktor Boot has to do with 9/11, has to do with what hit the Pentagon, has to do with very interesting and fascinating stories, you know, related to nuclear terrorism, as I explain in the Shadow Masters. And again, it's what's behind the scenes, which so often is more interesting than what's being, you know, trotted out for us, you know, in on the front pages of major leading newspapers.
And the Shadow Masters, again, available from Trinday Press. It came out in 2010. And is there any new English book on the horizon?
That's right. We are releasing in the next couple of months with Trinday, Deconstructing WikiLeaks. It's a fascinating book because it was released in Spain last year. It sold extremely well because basically what I said in February 2011 when it was first released is that the WikiLeaks and Assange is an NSA-CIA operation with various objectives in mind. One is the change of paradigm of society, basically make us understand history differently, you know, from how it is being understood in reality. And also the other point, key element, is shutting down internet. And we're seeing it right now. And as I said, in February 2011, I said the scenario being played out, and I saw semi-secret, or you'd say private documents from the Russian intelligence services. They were talked about several scenarios. One of them was being played out of the you needed another 9/11 to actually have the excuse to shut down internet. You couldn't have another 9/11 because we've already seen it, so they needed another one. So basically the idea that the Russians had come up with is the Americans would use somehow an attack by the Chinese hackers against American nuclear installations, with 300,000 or 400,000 dead, to actually have the, you know, the pretext to shut down internet. Well, we're seeing a similar version of these events played out over the last several days. I don't know if you've seen it in the newspaper, but Americans accusing the Chinese government and Chinese hackers working allegedly for the Chinese government of hacking two of their satellites. And needless to say, this is the same scenario with a very slight variation being played out, which I described back in February 2011. And Julian Assange is just a pawn in this game. In fact, Assange, according to the Russian KGB archives back in 1992, was part of this. He was actually back in the 1980s, he and this man by the name of Karl Koch and others formed part of this Chaos Computer Club in Hamburg, Germany. Koch was a legend, first hacker, you could say, on the world stage, the man who created the Trojan virus. He was working directly for the KGB, so the Russians knew back in the 1980s that people such as Koch, Dirk Brzezinski, Julian Assange, all formed part of this hacker community out of Hamburg. And when Julian Assange appeared in 2007, 2008, 2009, became the world celebrity, last year, it was very, very simple to understand how this whole story was being played out back from the early 1990s. So when I saw these elements, I saw these pieces of the puzzle, I thought it was time to do a book on WikiLeaks, and the result of that is this book, Deconstructing WikiLeaks, which basically explained exactly how the operation was put together, who Assange is, how he formed part of this when he was just a child, of this cult back in Australia called the Anne Hamilton Byrne cult, which was actually a front for the MacArthur program of the CIA in Australia, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, well, this book is coming out over the next few months in the United States, and I think it will make quite a splash, because the entire story of Assange, there's still a lot left to be said, and you obviously know that he allegedly will be extradited to Sweden, right? We saw this over the last few days.
That's right, yeah.
Well, I think what actually nobody understands is why he's being extradited to Sweden. See, it has nothing to do with alleged charges against him brought up by the Swedish government. The reason he is being extradited to Sweden has to do with the fact that out of all these almost 2 million pages of documents which came out in a case of WikiLeaks, there's only a very, very small percentage of these that are worth anything at all. And out of all of these papers, about 5 or 6 of these papers or documents have actually no value or real value. And that value was in these 5 or 6 documents which came out of the American embassy in Sweden and should never have actually seen the light of day, but they did because it was just too much information and it came out. And it basically shows how the United States government and the Swedish government, with the approval of the Swedish king, was spying on the Swedish citizens using Ericsson's technology, which is in the hands of the Wallenberg family, which of course is Bilderberg. So when this information, if it comes out and becomes public, we have seen this. And it's in my book. Unfortunately, it's still not part of the general know-how. But if it ever comes out that the American government and the Swedish government knowingly were spying on their own citizens with the approval of the King of Sweden, first of all, you would destroy the Swedish government. Second, it would probably eliminate forever the Swedish monarchy and would do irreparable damage to Ericsson and the Wallenbergs. And needless to say, they simply couldn't have all this information come out, which is, again, one of the reasons why they're trying to extradite Assange to Sweden, to make sure that he keeps his mouth shut.
Daniel, you're going to have to start writing your books in English first. Spanish can wait.
Well, I actually do them. I write them in English. But because I live in Spain, they first always come out in Spain. But anyway, it's the turnaround time is about six months. And Chris simply doesn't have the machinery. His publishing company is small, but I wouldn't think of publishing with anybody else because he's probably the only man in the United States capable of bringing out these types of books and withstand the pressure from the establishment and get them out into the open.
Indeed. Well, Trinde has published so much valuable information. So
exactly.
It's good to hear that it is coming out. So when can people expect that?
Probably by February, it's going to be out on the street. Deconstructing WikiLeaks.
All right. Looking forward to that. And I'm sure people can stay tuned to DanielEschelin.com for all the latest. I know you're a busy man, so thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks so much, James. Take care.